The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast hosts Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff from the Science Lab from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey guys, and welcome to the podcast. This is Allison Loudermilk, the science editor at HowStuffWorks.com.
And this is Robert Lamb, science writer at HowStuffWorks.com. And this is part two of a two-parter. Last episode, a thing called science, we talked about what science is in very sort of broad general terms, defining this thing called science and what it means, how it works, and how it's changed what we are as a species and a civilization.
Yeah, we've gotten a couple of requests for doing a podcast on the scientific method, and we will be tackling some of these big topics. And it really was important to us to talk about the scientific method as it is a core concept of all science.
Yeah, like scientific method, as we mentioned in the last podcast, it's basically how science advances, how it moves, how it claims new territory, like an advancing army, you know? To quote Carl Sagan, how it, brings light into a demon-haunted world, you know? So what's the history on scientific method, right? When did it come about?
Looks like it came out as far back as the 4th century BC.
Yeah. Though they didn't call it scientific method, and it can't really be attributed to, like, one person. But some of the ideas involved in it started emerging pretty early on.
Yeah, you got a guy, you guys might have heard of him, named Aristotle,
yep,
who proposed methods to answer questions about the world through rigorous observation.
Yeah, and that was way back in the 4th century BC.
Much later, Albertus Magnus comes along, and he borrowed some principles from Muslim scientists, and he described this repeating cycle of observation, hypothesis, experimentation, and verification.
Did you know that Albertus Magnus supposedly had an android?
I'm sorry, what?
An android?
No.
Yeah. It's like, look it up. It's pretty crazy. Like, it was probably not an actual robot, just to go ahead and get that out there. But he had like some sort of, if I remember this correctly, he had some sort of like, mannequin that maybe had some sort of mechanical.
He sure wasn't a golem.
I think those charges may have been, cause a lot of these older guys, like our next guy, Francis Bacon included, you know, they were curious about a lot of things. And sometimes that curiosity took them into, you know, exploring, less scientific and more magical ideas, you know, because that was, like I said, you didn't have as clearly defined a science back then, so it would sort of bleed into other areas. But yeah, he supposedly had an android. Francis Bacon, I don't think he did. But
he's important. We bring him up because he was really the first to formalize the concept of a true scientific method.
Mm-hmm.
And he, of course, as standing on the shoulders of giants, as these scientists tend to do, was basing his method on the work of Nicholas Copernicus.
And Galileo.
Yeah. Then along comes Mr. Newton, Sir Newton to us. And his laws really ruled the world of science for centuries. And he marked the beginning of the scientific age.
And don't we have a really good article on Isaac Newton on the site, don't we?
We do. And I have an outstanding request to do a blog post on.
Oh, yes, about his involvement in alchemy. Am I remembering this right? Or is it something else?
It's Arianism.
Oh, okay.
Newton and Arianism. So I will get to that at some point, I promise.
Cool. So yeah, Newton though was pretty much the beginning of the you know, our scientific age, he brought about the beginning of methods to that attempt to minimize the influence of bias and prejudice in the experimenter, and scientific method also provides an objective, standardized approach to conducting experiments.
And it's also about getting cred, right? You know, it's good, but it's about getting cred not only with other scientists, but with the public.
Yeah.
With, you know, the people who are going to be exposed to your work. And how do they know that you're conducting your work in a controlled and rigorous fashion?
Yeah. And you made a good point when we were preparing for this about nobody's perfect when it comes to experimentation and carrying out the scientific method. Like, there's no, like, we've named some pretty, stellar names, be it Aristotle or Galileo or Newton, but nobody's like free of criticism. Even like modern dudes like Hawking, it's like people will and do take Hawking to task on things that they think doesn't hold up to scientific scrutiny. And that's how science works. Like, nothing is set in stone.
Right. So you have to be open to colleagues' feedback, constructive criticism, although sometimes it can get a little gnarly. You can have some, like, the Bone Wars. Do you remember that when we were talking about dinosaurs?
Yeah.
These respected scholars, paleontologists, and all of a sudden they're battling over dinosaur bones. I publish first. No, you publish first. And never having been in a career where I need to publish to get ahead, I imagine it does get very heated. And the pressure's on to publish, to get funding, all the stuff, to be the one who's in Nature first or whatever publication you're
Highlights.
Aiming for. But getting back to your point...
Highlights was a good magazine. They had the page where you'd find the hidden objects in the painting.
I did. I used to read that in the doctor's office. But getting back to your point, there are two major forms of bias that creep into experiments, and we should mention them. Selection bias, and that occurs if the participants you select, for example, for an experiment aren't representative of a particular population. So selection bias. Say you're interested in whether people watch more TV at night, but you only go to a house, you only go to a neighborhood that's 55 and older. So.
Right. Yeah, that's not a good, like, cross section of the population you're looking to study.
Yeah, because maybe you're looking to, look at TV watching habits in a population from 30 and above, right?
Right.
So if you're only hitting the 55 and older community, probably not going to get that greater results. Not going to have an informed data. So you also can have observer bias. An example of this might be that a participant in an experiment couldn't remember correctly what his exposure to a particular variable was. So let's say you're interested in the question of influenza among a particular population of people, and your participant can't remember the number of times he hung out with runny-nosed nursery school kids, however you choose to word that in your experiment.
Well, cool. Well, let's...
So those are two examples of bias.
Well, cool. Well, let's... I guess it's time to actually begin the process, begin the scientific method.
Let's do it, Robert.
All right. So the first step is pretty basic, doesn't require a lot of explanation. Make an observation. And, I think we encounter this every day. You know, like, maybe you're on MARTA or something. MARTA is our public transportation train system here in Atlanta. And you look across the aisle and you go, I wonder, like, why that lady is eating an entire rotisserie chicken on the train. It's an observation, and it raises questions.
A rotisserie chicken lady.
It was weird. It was kind of gross.
That would be definitely gross.
Yeah. Now, that would be harder to – more scientific would be like – you know, like Charles Darwin observing, you know, different species of finches on the Galapagos Islands and asking himself, you know, huh, what's going on here? Why all this similarity, you know? Or, you know, things of that nature are definitely more in the scientific realm. Why is something the way it is? And that's the beginning.
Okay, but let's just get back to the rotisserie chicken. There's no reason why you couldn't come up with some sort of interesting experiment based around that.
Okay, well, okay, yeah, like the situation would be like, does this lady find it necessary to eat a rotisserie chicken with her fingers on the train and then touch the pole?
There's all sorts of there's all sorts of interesting stuff to be explored there. It doesn't have to be about finches or about, you know, particle accelerators. The very questions that, you know, surround us in our normal lives, I think, are worthy of investigation. Like, and I think it's just really worth emphasizing, because science does not have to be about these super unapproachable intellectual topics.
Right. Like the Ig Nobel Prizes.
The
Improbable Research Publication. They constantly cover peer-reviewed scientific, you know, papers that deal with kind of ludicrous-sounding, you know, questions. But nothing's, you know, like you say, nothing is really out of bounds for science. You know, questions of, like, what was one of the more ridiculous ones that I can actually mention in the podcast? Because the only ones coming to mind are
the ones that we probably should.
The risque ones.
I think there was something that's, there was a charcoal filter, a man who invented a charcoal filter so that when he, was feeling gaseous, there was, that wasn't really an experiment. That was more of an invention, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's the only one I can think of.
Yeah, but still, things of that nature. I mean, there are some scientific experiments I know for a fact, like dealing with NASA, that have to do with like how gassy people are, because that's an issue if you're going into space.
Indeed.
Right. So
bad breath.
So yeah, just about anything, no matter how ridiculous or seemingly insignificant, science can and often does analyze it. So we have a pretty insignificant sounding example, just a very hypothetical situation here around the office, right?
All right. Yeah. So Robert and I put together a little hypothetical experiment. And here's our experiment. We're going to make an observation. And here's the deal. Robert.
Yeah.
You are a big fan of pudding pops.
Okay.
For the purposes of this, yeah. So you're going to be bringing a stash of pudding pops to work.
Okay.
You're going to put them in the freezer.
Gotcha.
Don't put them in the fridge. Like, I put my ice cream cake for my 16th birthday in the fridge and it melted and that was really
sad.
Oh, man.
Why'd you bring that to work now? It's probably just as well. You shouldn't eat it.
No, back when I was turning 16.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, you've been bringing these pudding pops to work. You stash them in the freezer. Mm-hmm. 2 o'clock rolls around. You're really getting that, you know, urge for a pudding pop, which I guess grips some of us.
Yeah. Well, 2 p.m. That's a good time for it. Sugar, you know, need some sugar to keep going.
Yeah. So you've been noticing that the pudding pops are disappearing.
Hmm.
They're disappearing faster than you've been eating them. At least this is your thought.
Okay.
It's not like you're the kind of guy who, you know, marks his food in the freezer and ticks one off when you take one out of the box. So you've kind of observed.
Okay, we've observed. And this leads right into the next step in the scientific method, and that is ask a question.
Yeah, we got to narrow our focus of inquiry.
Right.
We got to identify the problem. You got to get specific.
Right. So the observation we made was that something is happening to these pudding pops. They're vanishing.
Am I the only one thinking of Bill Cosby right now?
Probably not, no. And then the question that immediately arises is, hey, what's happening to these pudding pops?
Is someone throwing them away?
Yeah. Are they atomizing and just, you know, are they slipping into another dimension?
And maybe the box is upside down and they're falling out of the box. And
on the way to work, and then I'm putting an empty box into the freezer. See, these are all interesting possibilities.
Or maybe, just maybe, somebody is eating your pudding pops.
Ah.
And it's not you.
Well, that leads to step three, right? Form a hypothesis. So there are all these possibilities. Now, the possibility that a tiny black hole is opening up in the Howstuff Works freezer and consuming pudding pops, well, I don't think that's very likely. Maybe it's possible, but it's extremely unlikely. Likewise, I feel like I'm pretty aware of my, you know, surroundings when I'm bringing things to work. They're probably not falling out of that box.
Okay.
So I'm going to go with the hypothesis, somebody's stealing my pudding pops.
Well, if they're vanilla flavored, nobody's stealing them. Chocolate, I might grant you that. So Right. So now we have this question, and let's formulate it correctly so that we can find an answer.
Okay.
And that's really the next step that we have going on here. We're going to suggest a possible answer in the form of a hypothesis. And a hypothesis is often defined as an educated guess.
Okay.
Because we sort of have this idea that, yes, maybe somebody is taking the pudding pops. Black holes, not really likely. Some of the other options, not so likely. So this is somewhat of an informed guess.
It's generally in the form of, like, if X, then Y, right?
Mm-hmm. And another important thing about the hypothesis is that you're going to have to define all the terms in there, right? So if our hypothesis is, let's see, if we leave a box of pudding pops in the fridge for a week, then Josh Clark from Stuff You Should Know will steal a pudding pop a day in the afternoon, excepting weekends.
Okay.
So what are we going to have to define there? Who is Josh Clark?
Yeah.
What is a pudding pop?
Mm-hmm.
What is stealing?
Indeed.
A couple of different things that we're going to have to know and be able to measure to see, in fact, whether our hypothesis is proven true.
And how are we going to find out if it's proven true?
We're going to have to devise an experiment.
Okay. And this is step four.
Step four.
Conduct an experiment.
This is the excitement.
So the hypothesis is that Josh Clark may be stealing a pudding pop a day. And
yeah.
just to clarify, I'm pretty sure Josh Clark is a fan of frozen yogurt and not pudding pops, but in real life. But for the purposes of the experiment, he is a pudding pop fiend.
Okay. All right. So let's conduct our experiment. Let's make it scientific.
All right. Well, how do you conduct a scientific experiment? Like, what are the...
Well, I mean, a lot of people listening are going to think of something that takes place in a lab. You know, mm-hmm. you're going to invoke Bunsen burners and lab workbenches and test tubes and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
Erlenmeyer flask.
Yeah.
Do you remember this?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
but it doesn't necessarily mean like
me and Allison going into a laboratory and like melting down pudding pops and like, you know, that kind of stuff.
No, our experiment can be pretty simple. And some really great experiments in science have been extraordinarily simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all about like...
Not that we would put our experiment on the level of this great experiment.
Right. But it's all about like keeping it on task and avoiding bias. So like...
And controlling your variables as much as you can. And then, you know, if you can't control for some of those variables, then analyzing the data later in a way that can. So maybe you run like linear regression. I can't believe I just pulled that out from stats.
Yeah. So you wouldn't want you're not conducting an experiment to prove Josh Clark is stealing pudding pops. You're testing a hypothesis. It may seem like a slight thing, but it really makes a lot of difference. You're supposed to avoid having any kind of like preconceived answer, you know? I mean, you can sort of have one, but not like officially, you know?
You can have an informed guess.
Yeah. You can have, you know, expected result, but not, you know, you're not setting out to prove that result exactly.
Okay. So let's roll our experiment. What are we going to do? We got to get some pops, right?
Yeah.
So let's say we're going to conduct our experiment over the span of a work week. So
okay.
Monday through Friday.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to put the pops in the freezer at the start of Monday morning.
Okay.
And we're going to add a hidden camera.
Okay.
I don't know where to get one of these if we were to conduct such an experiment. I guess they're probably pretty easy to get.
They probably have them in the video department.
Yeah.
Everywhere.
Yeah, so we're going to hook up the hidden camera, and then we're going to monitor the camera and see what happens with the pops, who's taking them, when. We're going to record the data. We're going to record you eating the pops. We're going to record everything about the pops.
Now, we're also going to need a control group, right?
Yeah, I suppose we could add the control group, yeah.
This is like when if you're testing a drug on people, like in a clinical trial,
mm-hmm.
like the test group would receive a placebo
mm-hmm.
or something. They would not receive the...
proposed therapy.
The proposed therapy, because you want to see how people respond just normally, right?
Yeah, I do think we need to do a podcast on the placebo effect, by the way.
I really want to do one.
Yeah. Okay, so we're going to also place a box of pudding pops in the freezer by the dev team.
Yeah.
And that should be interesting because they are a wacky bunch.
Yeah, and they're far away, you know, like for the purposes of this experiment, Josh Clark never goes there.
Yep. So. And also for the purposes of this experiment, the development team does not like pudding. They're all allergic to it.
Okay. All right.
All right. So they're a good control group.
All right. So we carry out this experiment, right?
Yeah. What do we find?
Well,
did we get some data?
Well, that's the thing. We have to move on to step five, which is analyze the data.
And draw a conclusion.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Deduce. Do a little deduction.
Yeah. So, for instance, let's say that we look at the data and it doesn't look like Josh is stealing these.
It doesn't?
Well, let's say that in this particular footage, like Josh is only showing up at the freezer like once a week, and we're still having one a day disappear.
So it's not Josh.
Yeah. So we would have to, at this point, reject the hypothesis. Right?
Yes. Yes, we would.
And then we would have to go backwards a few steps to the form a hypothesis level, and we'd have to form a new one. Maybe look into that black hole thing or
maybe look into the girls from, I don't know, stuff you missed in history class.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe they have a thing for putting bumps.
You never know. And likewise, if we were to look at the data and find proof that Josh was actually stealing these, then we would have to accept the hypothesis.
It would be validated.
Yeah.
And that would be nice.
And then maybe, you know, submit it to Highlights magazine for publication. Right?
Well, yes, of course. You bring up a good point. So after we're done analyzing the data and we've drawn conclusions and gone through all of the accepting or rejecting of the hypothesis, I'm not even going to get into the null hypothesis.
We're keeping it pretty simple for everybody here.
Right. So we're going to want to communicate the results of our experiment with our colleagues, with our fellow pudding pop scientists out there. We're going to, you know, want to see, hey, what did you guys think about how we conducted our experiment? Maybe we'll get, maybe we'll submit it to Highlights. So we have to go through peer review.
Mm-hmm.
And, one of the people who is a pudding pop expert will say, hey, you know what? Actually, I've done this experiment and you forgot to do XYZ. You didn't stick the camera in the right place because, yeah.
Yeah. Or, yeah, there are a number of problems that can come up, and they come up constantly. Like, if you actually look at any, you know, like, peer-reviewed publication, like, it's constantly, like, you know, people bringing up problems and just really tearing into studies that they don't agree with or find fault with or disagree with the methods.
Yeah, so there are limitations to science. I mean, it can't achieve everything. And clearly, the scientific method is a powerful tool, but it, too, has its limitations.
Yeah. For starters, a hypothesis has to be testable and falsifiable. And the experiments and observations have to be repeatable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can't do it like have an experiment that can only be done once.
You can't do science in a vacuum.
Right.
Well, I guess you could do science in a vacuum, but that's, you guys know what I meant.
Yeah, and it has to be testable. Like, it can't be, you know, nobody can have like a scientific experiment for is there a God? Because that's not testable. It's not something that is, you know, that's scientifically provable or disprovable.
Wow, I can't believe we went from putting pops to God in like the span of 5 minutes.
Well, some would say the distance is not that far, you know?
Yeah.
Especially fans of pudding pops, I guess.
Yeah, and sometimes you have instances where scientific principles are used to try to lend credibility to certain non-scientific ideas.
Yeah, like let's say, for instance, I were to have the bones of some like, you know, older, you know, hominid that may have, you know, evolved into a human. And I tried to make the case that this is an alien skeleton, you know, and, you know, and I like sort of applied some sort of pseudoscientific ideas. You know, people do this all the time where you kind of like take like one scoop of science and one scoop of crazy and or one scoop of just extreme bias and, you know, mix the two and, you know, produce this cake that a lot of people think is the real deal.
Which is why everybody should be educated in science. Everybody should have the tools to apply their critical thinking skills to a particular scientific problem or a scientific paper.
Right.
We all have them.
Right. And likewise, I mean, anything in science should be up. I mean, it should be just fair game for criticism, provided, you know, bring the science. The science is a tool that continually, you know, changes what we believe about the universe, you know? And it's, you know, nothing is sacred, you know? Use the tools of science to question what has come before.
No doubt. No doubt. That seems like a pretty good place to end. So we hope you've enjoyed our walk through the scientific method and our pudding pop experiment. And we hope you buy a big box of pudding pops right after this.
Right. And again, the pudding pop example is pretty simple. It's,
yeah, you know, very simple.
Yeah, we're just trying to get the basic structure out there for the scientific method.
So let's turn to something different.
Yeah,
for, a little listener mail.
Yeah, you have some listener mail there for us.
I do. Okay, so here goes. A while back, maybe you guys will remember that we covered oil in a two-part series
about looking for it and then harvesting it from the earth?
Yeah. Yep. And we put the call out for people who've worked on oil rigs to let us know how that was. And sure enough, we got somebody who responded. Thank you, Adam. And Adam sent us a pretty interesting note. So he says, "Hey guys, love the podcast. You did a great job summarizing both the addiction and how oil is explored slash produced. I worked in the oil industry for a few years after graduating as an electrical engineer from Ohio State. Go Bucks." That's in the email.
Oh, okay.
"You mentioned one of the things I used to do on the podcast, controlled explosions through the casing to facilitate the flow of oil gas into a newly drilled well. He also used to run a variety of tools into the well to help oil companies produce their wells more efficiently, from checking for plaque along the casing that minimizes diameter to see if one zone of production might be producing too much water. So all sorts of really interesting stuff around there." And then Adam goes on to add, "The oil rigs are not luxurious. They have minimal space used as efficiently as possible. I was on jackup rigs in the Middle East, the United Arab Emirates and Qatar, so that's my reference point. Maybe it's different in other parts of the world. None of the many rigs I worked on had a gym. If people wanted to exercise, they could walk in circles on the heliport."
Oh, my.
"It's true, there were quote-unquote chefs and quote-unquote doctors, but they didn't exactly have Culinary Institute diplomas or MD certificates hanging on the walls. Platforms, on the other hand, are like a small city, and these amenities are common." So if you're a workout fiend and you're interested in working for oil, I guess platforms would be the way to go.
I like the idea that the doctors had culinary diplomas, but not the, but not the chefs.
That's not what he was saying. So Adam adds, "These platforms are there for the long haul, and they're designed to be livable. Also, in most areas of the world, the production is taken over by the national oil company. Thus, the platform mainly houses workers from that country, or at least that country's oil company's staff. During the drilling process, the oil company may represent 1 to 2% of the personnel on the rig at any given time." He sent us a picture of him on a rig, and he's behind an explosive sign with a white hard hat.
Oh, wow.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't. I'll have to look that up.
So he writes on, "I no longer work in the industry, thankfully. As you mentioned, the pay is excellent and the benefits are good depending on who you work for. The oil service companies typically paid better but treated employees worse. I took the money I made and did an MBA at a top 10 business school in Spain." Go Adam! "And will actually start my first post-MBA job next week at a wind turbine company in Denmark."
Oh, well, that's an interesting end of the story.
Well, yeah. So he says, this is the close. "Yes, working in the oil industry fueled my passion to get into renewable energy. I think anyone involved in the process can see how unsustainable it is. Hope you found this marginally interesting." We did. We totally did. Thank you really. Thanks a ton for writing, Adam.
Yeah. I mean, even if it is unsustainable, certainly, and, you know, a lot of opinions vary about the use of oil and the oil industry in general. But as we mentioned in the actual podcast, the process involved in finding the oil and then extracting it is just really fascinating because, like we say, when someone's addicted to something, they'll go to extraordinary means to get what they're addicted to. And we go to extraordinary means to get that oil. And it's really amazing because there's some cool, just excellent technology involved in it.
Yeah, and some excellent minds. Mm-hmm. So, hey, if you guys have any thoughts that you want to send us, whether they're about oil or the scientific method, or pudding pops, send us an email at sciencestuff@howstuffworks.com or connect with us. We're on Facebook, Stuff from the Science Lab, or Twitter. We're Lab Stuff.
Yeah, we'll constantly update you on what we're podcasting about, blogging about, and also just like, I love to update it with just cool science stuff that I find on the web.
Yeah. So look us up, and thanks for listening, guys. We appreciate it.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Want more How Stuff Works? Check out our blogs on the HowStuffWorks.com homepage.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.